ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
He was the man who stole the plans for the atomic bomb. A brilliant physicist, a devoted communist. A spy hiding inside the most secret project on Earth. This is the story of Klaus Fuchs, a man who believed he could serve two masters, science and the Soviets. To hear it, search for The Bomb on the ABC Listen app.
Who picks and processes the fruit and veggies you buy each week? Did you know it could be a nurse or a police officer from a Pacific island or Timor Leste? A workforce we rarely hear about and lives in limbo. That's today on Big Ideas. Hello, welcome. I'm Natasha Mitchell.
Like one young guy I met up far north Queensland who was living in a very small little country town. And, you know, we had a great chat, and at the end he says to me, you know, I've been here over a decade on the 9-month seasonal program and I'm not home long enough to form a relationship or keep a relationship. I'm not married. I'm in my late 20s. I might not be able to have kids at the rate I'm going. And he says to me, how much more fruit do I have to pick for Australia to give me citizenship? My heart just broke. Like, I just thought, because I've heard this story again and again, not quite as potent as his words, but he'd thought about it. And then there's another guy I met in a small inland village in Citrus area, and he says, oh, I've picked, you know, so much fruit for this town, they could put a bronze statue of me in the main street.
Dr. Kaya Barry from Griffith University's Centre for Social and Cultural Research has been really closely documenting the experiences of seasonal migrants who do farm work across regional Queensland. And what she's heard is eye-opening.
And so I thought, you know, these are people who return year after year on a short-term contract to this tiny little town where, as another person said to me, well, I don't play footy, so they don't want to know me. And these are the sort of sentiments that I get. And I've just walked in and met them that day. So, you know, that guy in the citrus town, he'd been there 9 years to the same town. It's 3.5 hours drive to the nearest KFC. And that's his number one thing he said that he loves being in Australia for. So, well, it's number two, second to money. But, you know, every couple of weeks, him and his mates drive 3.5 hours to the nearest town to get KFC. Like, that's the reality. That's their highlight they're looking for. And yes, that's country life, but we as Australians have a choice in that. They don't. He has no say in where he'll be put in his job next season if he gets invited back.
For many, this seasonal work in Australia is life-changing because they can earn more here than they do in their home countries. They're here as part of what's now called the Pacific Australia Labour Mobility or PALM scheme. This allows people from 9 Pacific Islands and Timor-Leste to apply for temporary visas to work in Australia, either short-term 9-month visas to do seasonal jobs or more recently longer-term visas of up to 4 years. People on this visa might harvest your fruit and veg or process your meat. Some also work in hospitality, aged care and other industries. Australia depends on this workforce. There are big economic benefits for the nearly 500 Australian employers in this scheme and for the nearly 30,000 employees. But there are also significant challenges. The conditions of this visa are very strict. There have been cases of serious exploitation and of absconding. And what is it really like to cycle in and out of Australia on short-term visas in this prolonged state of limbo between two homes, in some cases, for years?
Like most of the people, their mindset while they're in Australia only for working and to get the money, you know, just come for work and spend all their life and working. For me, like, why just spend your life for work? You need to learn something. You need to express yourself. You need to get some, you know, happiness in while you're doing your life in Australia, not just only for work and work and work.
By all accounts, Nunes Cosbar is a very committed and hard worker, a musician and a photographer from Timor-Leste. He's one of the contributors to a recent photographic exhibition called Temporary. We wanted workers, but we got people. It's a powerful title, isn't it? Organised by Griffith University and the Australian National University. Now in his early 30s, Nunes and his wife, both on palm visas, met each other working for the same employer and have been travelling to and from Australia to work for the same berry company over 8 years now. Joining me for this event at the ANU are also Emma Vuetti, President of the Pacific Islands Council of Queensland, which supports and advocates for Pacific Islander communities here. Ken Darchi is Coordinator of Welcoming Workplaces with Welcoming Australia. He's based in Leeton in the Riverina region of New South Wales, which hosts many palm visa workers. And Nunes joined us via Zoom on the day from Timor-Leste. He'd had to race home for the very sad occasion of his mother's funeral, but I re-recorded with him later. Let's start with Emma Vuetti on the benefits of the palm scheme from her perspective.
When you listen to the voices of the workers themselves, they are benefiting markedly in, you know, bettering their lives back at home and also getting new skills. And the Australian society, I mean, without our workers or our people, we wouldn't be having, you know, punnets of strawberries and whatnot in the supermarket. So it's a win, win, win. Win for the worker, win for all the people who are coming to work, win for the government that's sending them, and win for our Australian society. So, you know, in the midst of the challenges, for most of them, they would rather continue to work because they financially benefiting, but there's something in them that wants to stay. In Fiji, there's a saying that goes like this, lavo ni ozi, na lavo mosi mosi. That literally means Australian money is painful.
Australian money is painful.
Yes. And so, you know, in the culture, that translates to the hard work, the blood, sweat and tears that they have to go through. And the
literally blood, sweat and tears.
And the not so nice things that some of them have to go through.
And we will come to those. Ken Darchi, benefits from your perspective. As someone who supports both workers, but also you have worked alongside communities, councils and other civic providers to support workers in often regional or remote communities in the work that you do.
The benefit that I, in an everyday way, do experience and see are the people-to-people ties and the revitalization of rural regional communities that are traditionally really small. So you have small towns and you have these newcomer arrivals that just rejuvenate the entire social fabric. So a place like Leeton, it becomes noticeable when you have your annual cultural celebration. If I think 6 years ago, the entire organization and the attendance was really low. There wasn't variety in offering.
So this is like an annual cultural festival.
Yeah, this is an annual cultural festival. But you now look at it, even from that point of organization all the way to how it is delivered, it is purely fed by Pacific Australia Labour Mobility community members. So for me, the greatest benefit is that, has been that social connection.
One of the things that I also want to bring in as a benefit is the churches in the regional locations in Queensland are very happy to have our workers because the workers are part of their congregation and they provide the choir on the Sunday or also some of the cultural, you know, aspect to the spiritual support that's been given.
Kaya Barry, from your perspective, what are the benefits? And then I'll drill in with you a little further as to what your work's revealed.
I mean, I've spoken to many workers and they would say money. But I think it, like Ken says, it goes far beyond that. I think it's the community experience they get. because they're living and working alongside people from many different cultures and nationalities. It's not usually just one nation in one farm on their own. So it's not just Australian communities, but it's other nations from across the Pacific. There's also the backpackers on the working holiday makers who are from all around the world, from almost 50 countries now. So it's, in a way, it's like that cultural exchange, you know, immersion that they're getting, and in these really beautiful landscapes too, very different, very vast, very lush sometimes. That's often, it's that more touristic side that I think they appreciate too, because often they're places that they would never get to, that we also hardly get to. So I think getting a bit more diversity of different landscapes, different people, but definitely, as Ken said, it's the communities that you form and the friendships that are long-lasting.
Often with fellow workers, but also
with
local
workers,
communities.
But with locals, with the support staff they work around, with the admin, the cleaning staff, you know, it's not, it might be the farmer, it might be all the other people who are in the picture who help, you know, pick and pack and get it all off the farms out to market.
Your work, you interviewed upwards of 80 different people who were here in Australia on these temporary visas, but you also interviewed employers, you interviewed all sorts of people in civic services, police, all sorts of people as part of your ambitious work. How candid were people about the difficulties?
Too candid. There's a lot of challenges. This particular visa program has shifted and evolved and changed, and it gets tweaked all the time. And that can be really frustrating for everybody involved in the maintenance of it and doing things, you know, by the rules and by the book. So there's a lot of frustration of just whether, you know, the workers are doing the right thing, whether the employers are doing the right thing. So it might be, you know, for workers, if you're only employed on a 9-month, you know, seasonal contract, it's waiting every 9 months to see whether you'll be invited back by the farm or whether you'll be moved to somewhere else across the country, or what will happen if you go home for your break. Will you come back? You know, that being in limbo, that a short-term job, let alone a short-term livelihood that's built around a visa, brings. And that's frustrating for employers too, for farmers who genuinely care and you know, are really good friends with a lot of their workers, especially the smaller scale businesses who host them, because they also don't know. It's market demands. It's also visa approvals, which is outside of everyone's control. So I think there's a lot of frustration about just the temporary nature of this program, even for the 4 year, because there's the longer term version of the
visa.
A
more recent addition to the scheme.
Yeah, and that provides some certainty, but 4 years flies past in an instant. And, you know, many of these people, the majority have families back home. So 4 years is a long time when your kids are growing up back home without you, but it also flies past, you know, when you're trying to plan for what comes next. Do you want to sign on for another 4-year contract? It might be 4 years of being moved from job to job, location. Like Nunes moves between two different states throughout his employment throughout the year. So there's still a lot of uncertainty, even with the longer periods.
So paint a picture of the day-to-day reality of many of the workers that you spoke to. What's life like? Where are they living? And obviously it's a range, but how are they getting a rental if they're only here for 9 months? And how hard are they working on many of these farms? What are the hours like? What's their week look like?
Well, in short, they're not getting rentals. Their accommodation is largely managed for them by the employer who brings them in on the visa program. So most of them live in shared sort of hostel accommodation, and that can vary between, you know, bunk beds in dorm rooms where you've got 6, 10, 12 people sharing one living space. Or, you know, some of the more flash facilities will have, you know, independent sort of self-contained units. Big communal cooking areas, big communal bathroom areas. So it's very communal living. And that's okay for short term, but imagine, like Nunes, you've been doing that for 8 years. That can get a bit tiring. So that's a frustration that people air. But, you know, the farm work is hard. I've just focused on farm workers, but they also are in abattoirs and aged care and many other industries. But I can talk about the farm workers. The alarm will go off at 4. They drag themselves out of bed, get changed, grab their lunch that they've prepared the day before from the fridge, and then they'll go out. If it's a rural place, often they'll go out and they'll wait along the roadside in the dark, waiting for the shuttle bus or the van or Joe Blow down the road to come and pick them up. And then depending on how far their farm site is from where they live in a small little town, it can be a 45-minute drive one way, it can be over an hour.
Unpaid time.
Unpaid time. If it's in the country, there's generally not good mobile coverage. And so a lot of them, you know, it's an hour or more commute with nothing to do. So they sleep and then they get to the farm, they get out, they go straight into work, and they are so incredibly hardworking. Like every time I'm on site visiting farms and I see these people up trees pruning things and the baskets full of all sorts of citrus shoot and things, I think, wow, I would die after like 30 minutes of that. So I'd keel over.
On Big Ideas, we're exploring the experiences of Pacifica and Timorese people who work in Australia, often in horticultural industries, on a temporary visa as part of what's called the Pacific Australia Labour Mobility or PALM scheme. Let's connect again with Nunes Cosbar. He and his wife, who met on the job, they have been working for the same berry company for over 8 years on the PALM scheme. Why did you want to come to Australia on the Pacific Australia Labour Mobility or PALM visa scheme? What interested you about that?
Yeah, be honest, the first time I was doing my music performance in Delhi, and, you know, I was very young and I don't know what to do on my life. So, which is when I realized that one day I need to work and I need to build my future. If I'm Timor, I'm in Timor. Mm. I know I can do my future, but I don't know where I have to go.
What does your job involve doing?
I have many things. I'm doing driving berry drivers at the farm, like collect all the berries, bring to the cool room, and I'll be supervisors, like, you know, checking people doing the good, right job, you know, telling them don't do that, and just, you know, pick the good berries. That one, and yeah, helping the management. And also I'm picking raspberry, strawberry, blackberry, everything in the farm. Like mostly of the job we have to do, like because I'm very active people, so I would like to do what job is left, then I'm going straight away to, you know, to do.
So you do driving, you do supervision, you do berry picking. How long are the hours?
It depends on the weather condition. When the season is high, we might work 10 hours, 11 hours. Yeah.
Long days.
It's really long day.
What difference does that income make to you and your wife's life, but also your family back home?
Me and my brothers, we built our parents' house. Now, so far, I still keep working. And me and my wife, now we're doing our apartment, like two small house in Tibor for making apartment.
Building an apartment,
yeah,
for,
yeah, apartment
for you?
For you. Me and my wife, so we can give to people, rent it to make some money.
So you're a musician, you perform with your brother. What's the name of your band? And do you get to perform in Australia?
Yeah, my band in Delhi, my band name is Kibit. So, yeah, me and my brothers, we play in Timor with the Kibit band. But now we have one group in here, which is Liangusi Timor, the voice of Timorese, Timor-Leste. We perform all our traditional music. All the music is from our legend, creation, the music that we always remind in our heart, in our mind. We listen to the music, then it's keep bringing us to remind to our friend that, you know, life is easy when you take it easy.
You work so hard, but you do try and keep music in your life,
yeah,
as a musician.
Yeah, that's why some of the friends, they told me, you and your brother's crazy. I said, what? You know, we just go there for work. Why are you both doing something that's crazy? I said, man, this is life. Don't just only keep working. You need to make something. You know, you came from the country that no one knows about your country, but You just keep working without do anything. No one know your country. You have to do something to tell the people that this is us. This is us from East Timor. We're here.
We are here.
Yeah. But, you know, for me, I'll always try to do, you know, I'm keeping busy, but I try to, you know, express yourself, not just... I know work is very important, but you need to do something else for your life as well. Otherwise, you get boring.
That's true.
Yeah.
You need recreation. You need
yes, of course.
Creative expression. And have you been able to perform with your brother at festivals or venues?
Yeah, we do performance 2 times now. But me and my brother, we did in 1 time. And this year was my friend Leo. He flew from East Timor to come here just for performance.
And does your employer allow you to time off to go and perform?
Yes. This is the big things we, you know, none of the workers, you know, get the opportunity to, like what I did. Because my employers, they very understand their workers. I mean, especially myself, because I've been away from, you know, the work for many times already for asking, doing my exhibition photos about music performance. They always, you know, very support me to go wherever I'm going. Yeah, this is very positive thinking.
Sounds like they see you as a full person.
Yeah.
Rather than a worker.
Yeah, not just a worker. They're very, especially my boss, she's very proud of me and very understand what I feel.
Do you think it's like that for many workers and their employers?
I'm not sure, because some of the workers, they are surprised while they saw me arrive in Melbourne. Say, how come you? They was thinking I'm already out of the program. Then that's why they have many questions. Why? How come you can come here, man? You already run away from your company? I say, no, I'm still with my company. Oh my goodness! Did you allow to come here? Yes, of course. This is what my company did. Yeah, the good things is my company always support what you want to do. Yep.
Nunes Cosbar has a very positive relationship with his employer, a berry company operating in both Tasmania and Queensland. And his boss has allowed him to take time off to travel for music, for his participation in a photographic exhibition called Temporary, We Wanted Workers But We Got People, which is where I'm bringing you this episode of Big Ideas today at the ANU in Canberra. But look, the strictures of the Pacific Australia Labour Mobility or PALM visa scheme, employing people such as Nunes and his wife from the Pacific and Timor-Leste to do seasonal work, often means things don't always go smoothly. Hi, Natasha Mitchell, joined today by Emma Vuetti, President of the Pacific Islands Council of Queensland, Ken Darchi, who's coordinator of Welcoming Workplaces with Welcoming Australia, based in Leeton, New South Wales, and Dr. Kaya Barry from Griffith University's Centre for Social and Cultural Research. We've heard over the years reports of terrible living conditions, of exploitative work practices and employers, of wage theft. There's a recent report out from RMIT that was looking at the meat industry, and the picture it paints of worker exploitation is very, very poor. I mean, people make a choice to do this work, but I'm interested to know what choice, Kaya, you think they have when they get here, particularly in relationship to them being tethered to one employer. Does that make them more at risk of exploitation?
Certainly, yeah. Before the pandemic, there was widespread exploitation. I did some pilot research and interviews, and it was just everywhere, people being hideously underpaid. It was just shocking conditions that people were living and working in. So because their accommodation is usually managed by the visa scheme, it's tied directly to your work. It is a lot better now. There have been more regulations and by far, most people have a very good experience and they have a good quality of life that's provided. It's not everywhere, but, you know, it's still there, the exploitation. But what gets me is the more, you know, intangible things. So they don't have any choice of their employer once they're here. If something goes drastically wrong, they can put in a request, an appeal, and they might get moved. You know, if they are being exploited and it gets proven, they can be moved to a different job or a different location, but it's incredibly hard. So if you can imagine that the farmer you work for
owns the hostel in town where you also live, who runs the shuttle bus, and you have a problem and you want to speak out, it makes it very difficult.
Mm.
So it's a very closed circle between, you know, their whole livelihoods being managed for them. And then once they're on the ground, yes, they have a choice to come here to Australia. They have a choice if they'd like to come back next season for the next visa. But they don't have the same kind of rights and flexibility that many other temporary visa holders, let alone Australian citizens, have in their employment.
Emma Vuetti, President of the Pacific Islands Council of Queensland, let's drill into this a little further, because your organisation and your vast network of other organisations under your umbrella are all about supporting people when they get into trouble. What are some of the situations that you see that people need support around?
So before I answer that, I was just going to also add to what Kaya said. I think through the years, the scheme has improved. Our organisation has been supporting workers since 2012. And since that time, we've seen the decrease of workers coming to our organisation for support. And that's shown that the systems and all the mechanisms that are put in place now is working. So going back...
You hope. You know, or you hope?
I know that it is working.
Yeah. So what have the big changes been that were a problem, that are less of a problem now? But certainly you're advocating on a few different fronts, and one of them is access to Medicare, for example.
Yes.
So what's going wrong for people's health? What sorts of things do you see?
So it just depends on the sector and the industry. So there can be injuries. However, there are mechanisms in place now. Before, that wasn't there. We've got also systems in place in terms of what the welfare support, which is great. However, one of the other things that has been put in place is what we are part of, and it's the Community Connections Program. That program is a federal-funded program, which had started in 2021. The aim of the program is to connect the worker and the employer to all the services and all the churches, the clubs that are in that location.
So they're embedded in a community, which must be hard if you're on a nine-month visa or a year visa. You're kind of in the community, then you're out of the community. You may not go back to that community if you get another visa. So that must be quite chaotic for people's lives.
I'll turn this around and talk about when our workers are coming, they're coming because they have that aim that they need to work for their families. So, you know, they know that they're here for that amount of time. And, you know, quite seldom do most of them think about, you know, the short length of time that they are here to work in. Most of them are here because they are here to work.
They're on a mission.
Yeah, they're on a mission.
What about the impact of back home on families,
on
communities? Yeah. You've talked to me about, for example, some of the people who come here are police or teachers. You know, they have professional skills in their home countries. They come here because they're going to earn more money. Is that a brain drain back in communities? Or nurses?
Nurses. I said this is where the sending countries may need to put mechanisms in place to vet their applicants. However, at the end of the day, people in the islands will give up those jobs to come in and get better paid jobs here. Mm. And that's what's happening.
What about the impact on children who are back home, or partners, mothers? That must be an issue in terms of it's like a fly-in, fly-out sort of workforce. Does that cause some social problems?
It has.
Relationship problems?
It has. One of the things that we've advocated for is making sure that the church network, the community network back at home are involved, so that before mum or dad leaves, that network is working. And when I'm talking about that network, I'm talking about churches, I'm talking about community, village groups.
So people aren't isolated.
They're not isolated.
Right. Yeah. Ken Darcy, from Welcoming Workplaces and Welcoming Australia, so you've seen many of the issues firsthand that we're discussing today, haven't you?
Yes.
I mean, we've talked about some of the positive relationships in church communities, cultural festivals, but is there also sometimes a feeling of resentment that Pacifica workers are taking local jobs, or is there also racism?
There is an appreciation that we require workers. If rural regional economies don't fix the economic question or answer the economic question, then all the other associated benefits will not be there. So one great threat, obviously, is the collapse of regional economies. Mm-hmm. So then there is an appreciation of the need. What we don't agree on is the mechanism to administer a program of this kind. So then when it comes to the question of resentment, it's the gaps in the administration that triggers the resentment. Why can't this work better and yet we have derived mutual benefits from it?
Do people experience culture shock when they arrive? Is,
that's inevitable.
What does that look like?
So you have the host community that is not accustomed to wonderful, wonderful newcomer community members hanging out in cliques and just storytelling the whole of Saturday. They're like, what are these people up to? Can they find something else to do? And that's not really the issue. It's the lack of understanding by the receiving community about the cultural aesthetic of the people who are coming in. And so we have within the provisions of the PALM scheme, the Pacific Australia Labour Mobility Scheme, what we call pre-departure and arrival briefings. I will tell you that I've only witnessed one arrival briefing in a six-year time period. So that tells you that for a community like the one I've been resident for the past 6 years, has very limited understanding of actually who's coming, what are the cultural markers for the group that is coming, and then amplify that within the context of work. You had dear friend Kaya mentioning that in some of these work contexts, you have over 50 nationalities. So, you know, you have someone arriving to the United Nations. What are you going to do? So, and what do organizations, in terms of their preparedness, do in order to seamlessly accommodate these new arrivals of workers?
But thinking about small towns as well, do people sometimes turn up and maybe there's a church, but maybe there's also a pub? Maybe there's a sporting club, and that might be it, right?
And it's sufficient. What I'm trying to say is if there's that understanding from the point where you're departing your country, you manage your expectations. You know, the town where I'm going to be resident for the next 4 years has one sports club. And I may need to learn how to play Australian rules and move away from rugby. I may need to understand that my religious persuasion or my faith persuasion may not have representation where I'm going and may have to plant a new community of believers within that context. But if the two distinct groups would understand that, the receiving community and the sending bodies, if there is that link maintained continually across the program, you have better outcomes.
Emma, did you want to pick up on something?
Yeah, I was also wanting to say in relation to the racism and the locals saying, why are they here taking our jobs? And I think this is where media and conversations in whether media comes in to help, you know, the mainstream understand what is happening. In addition to that, I also wanted to mention the issue around racism. It's still, for some of us, we do get to have to deal with that. Mm. And for us, one of the things that we've tried to do is have conversations within locations. So, and then we draw in the services that are involved in trying to educate, carry out community education. Here in Australia, we've got a lot of funding and a lot of services that do multicultural community services. And I think this is where, you know, maybe Home Affairs might need to think about, you know, educating the wider community as well around the changing, you know, our society is changing. Mm. We're more multicultural now.
It's important to understand that because they're here as temporary visa holders, they're generally not represented or targeted by those kinds of community support networks that, you know, good government services that are there around multicultural communities and things. They're generally not counted as part of the community in the census data. Like, they're not filling out census forms. So councils often that host hundreds of workers don't actually know how many temporary people are there on the ground, because especially if they don't live in town, if they're living off-site at a big industrial meatworks processing place or on farms, the locals don't actually know how many people live alongside them in that region.
With what consequences?
Well, I mean, for, you know, councils and planning, like, think of disaster management. If you don't know that there's 500 people on a blueberry farm up in the hills and, you know, a cyclone comes through, what are you going to do? How do you plan to support those people, to relocate, to evacuate? For health, I mean, they all have to have private health insurance. It's very expensive, the premiums that they pay for their insurance. But that puts pressure. If the local base hospital doesn't know that there's 1,500 workers coming in for 6 months of the year, how does state governments then plan to better support and resource the communities more broadly with adequate healthcare? It's just not there. And that's put a huge pressure on rural communities because they're already struggling in all these areas.
And that's where resentments can fostered.
Yeah, especially, you know, and because they're in hard manual labour work, the rate of, you know, injury, heat stroke, it can be muscle spraining, but you end up at the hospital in the nearest regional town because there's no GPs available in these tiny little villages. So they're driving, you know, hours to go to a hospital, and you get there and, you know, anecdotally, I've heard from many people, half the waiting room in emergency is filled with Pacific workers because they're there because they need to see a doctor, because these towns have not been, you know, built and grown around having extra temporary populations on this scale before.
Big issue. Ken Dutchy, you also are very active and vocal about, some people call it absconding, you prefer the word disengagement.
Yeah.
So
yeah,
this is where workers leave their employers,
yeah,
which they're not, you know, the visa requirements say that they have to stay working and they have to stay,
yeah,
connected to this employer.
Yeah.
So they essentially become undocumented.
Yeah.
How big an issue is that?
Contextually, where I do live, it just became a very, very complicated problem.
The point that you've made to me is,
yeah,
that this makes those people even more vulnerable.
Yes.
In what ways? Tell us this story.
All right. So one would disengage for a variety of reasons. Wage theft, okay, welfare supports in the absence of the same, underemployment, you're contracted to work for a certain number of hours, but you end up working fewer hours.
So you're not earning enough.
Yeah, you're not earning enough.
And yet you spent all this time,
yeah,
away from your,
yeah,
family.
Yeah. So then you will leave that employment not understanding you can't just move from one employer to the next. Now, the associated consequences are what are damaging, and they range. Oh, the spectrum is huge. There's mental health breakdown. We've had numerous cases where we'd have to take someone to hospital. And again, same story. There's no Medicare, there's no private cover, because once you disengage, you lose those requisite benefits. It then compels local community members to pick up the tab. Now, when you have a willing cohort of local government areas that continually see this problem, they will definitely galvanize a movement. And that's what informs the Mayoral Alliance for the Pacific, which is a huge advocacy group that brings together local government areas that began noticing that this is a common denominator problem of disengagement. So it's local government that actually shoulders a responsibility, because all these are emergency scenarios, whether it is medical related or whether it's social related. We've even had, you know, drink driving incidences. We've had domestic violence incidences. We've had pregnancies. In Lytton alone, last year, we had 7 women were pregnant.
Who were palm workers?
Were palm workers. Now, we don't know what circumstances led to the pregnancy. Were they in relationship? Were they abused? We couldn't tell. But we had to pick up and sort out the issue because it was an emergency situation. Then the bringing together of all these local government areas led by the respective mayors has given us the muscle to actually advocate in the further upper tiers or spheres of government.
And what are you advocating for? Because councils have a lot on their plates.
Yeah.
You know, they're involved in managing rates, so
yeah.
Managing roads.
Roads and rubbish, three R's, yeah.
That's right, the three R's, that's right. Yeah. That's what I was looking for. But so asking them to also engage on pastoral care matters,
yeah.
Personal care matters,
yeah.
Housing, monitoring and regulating employers, that's a tough ask.
No, actually, within the provisions of what we call community strategic plans across local government areas, there are those salient pronouncements of what needs to be done and delivered within community services. So what the Mayoral Alliance has come up with is a set of proposals and our position paper.
So let's get tangible. What sorts of solutions? And also targeting employers as well.
Because with employers, we need to move from a deficit-based approach where it's always a need for skills that is pronounced and it's valid. The skills are needed, workers are required. But how ready are all these employers to successfully absorb the available workforce and the people? It's actually people.
Do they have the people skills?
They don't.
Do they also obey the laws?
Yeah, and they don't. Some don't. And I'm not saying that the entire court of businesses are breaking the law. But it then emphasized the need for what we call employer readiness. We can get the people ready get the workforce ready to break into the job market, but we need to get businesses ready to successfully accommodate the same the people into employment. We need to know at local government level the number of arrivals. We don't need to the specific detail, but just an overall appreciation of who's coming into town and the length of time they're likely to be in town. In case of any loopholes, which are inevitable, how do we escalate these issues? Who do we talk to within the Community Connections Program? Who's our closest contact? We need all this systematically ordered for it to be a coherent way of managing the program. One other area is to be really proactive in how the three spheres of government actually speak to each other. We want it to be understood that when we have a case of a community member who's a palm worker who's disengaged, they may present an immigration problem because of a disengagement, they've lost all their rights to be in the country. It presents an employment problem because they may have wanted to change an employer. And it presents a foreign policy problem because we need to maintain cordial relations with our Pacific sisters and brothers.
Yeah. Kaya, do you have some thoughts to add about that? Have workers spoken to you about the strictures that they experience, whether they want to bail from their current employer? But also, I gather from your work, many, many conversations end with, ma'am, can you help me get a visa, a permanent residency here? Can I bring my family here?
So out of all the interviews I've done, which is over 80 with palm workers in this current project, but that's on top of over 120 on the prior project, 90% of the interviews, that, you know, I switch off the audio recorder and, you know, thank them for their time and everything, and then they'll say, oh, miss, how do I become a citizen? How can I bring my kids here? How do I do university here? I want to learn.
And that's not an option. They can't get education while they're here, and they can't get permanent residency.
They can't. No, not in the current program. So the way that this, like many temporary visas in Australia, there's no clear pathway towards, if you work a certain number of years, you're then eligible to apply for permanent residency. They can sometimes be sponsored by an employer. So if the employer can prove that this person has the right skills and we can't find any local Australians to do this particular role, then the employer can then try and sponsor them. But it's incredibly paperwork and costly process to go through, and most employers that I've interviewed who've tried have been denied by Home Affairs, so the visas have been rejected. So the idea that whereas other visas like student visas, even working holiday maker visas, professional skilled visas, the pathway to get towards being eligible to be able to stay long-term in Australia, let alone become a citizen, it's sort of there. It's still very hard, but it's sort of there. For Palm, that's just not... it's not an option because they're in low-skilled work, and our migration doesn't want low-skilled work. They want high-skilled workers. So the interviews that I do, it's usually right at the end. The interview's over with the people. And these desperate questions, like begging, you know, leaning over the table asking me, like, how can you make this happen? How can I do better? Because I'd like to stay. And it's not to say that all of them want to stay forever in Australia, or even if they became a citizen somehow, that they'd never go back to their country. That's not how this works. And as Emma would know, you know, the Pacifica diaspora is so rich and there's so much engagement across the region. But we should be giving them a choice. Nobody's asking them what they'd like. It's just the assumption that, well, they've signed up, they know they're only coming for 9 months or up to 4 years. It's their choice. They know it's short term. But there's no other conversation happening around that. And the workers, clearly from the ones I've met, really would like to have a little bit of input into this.
Emma, do we, in this scheme, forget the human at the heart of this story?
Yes, and I think they're people. And I will always refer to them as people.
Not workers.
Not workers. Because when... and their visas require them as workers. You know, for the... I'll be selfish here, because as a Pacific Islander, I've heard our leaders say over and over again to all the governments that I've come across here that the Pacific needs a visa that will allow our Pacific people to come in and work and holiday without having to pay. Quite often, the governments in the Pacific have been saying that. And so Australia needs to, you know, also do something around that.
So to have a closer, more flexible arrangement. I mean, they talk about that in terms of a security risk. You know, we need to maintain good relationships with our Pacific friends, our Pacific neighbours.
Families.
The threat of China. You know, there's this bigger foreign policy story that gets wrapped around Pacifica and Timor-Leste workers, isn't there, on this scheme?
So we are needing to look at this broader than the current circular migration. Australia really needs to think about how we're looking at our neighbours in terms of the migration systems that we've got. Because, you know, it's okay for other developed countries to come in and out. It's okay for us here in Australia and New Zealand to go to the countries. But when our, you know, the Pacific wants to come, they have to pay quite a lot to come here. You know, at some stage, we will need to think a lot more than just these, you know, temporary visas for the Pacific.
Let's come back to musician Nunes Cosbar from Timor-Leste now, who has been cycling in and out of Australia on a temporary work visa for years now. You've been coming backwards and forwards now between East Timor and Australia for 8 years. These are 9-month visas or 4-year visas. You're not allowed to stay in Australia in between. You have to go back, reapply. Yeah. And it's not guaranteed, is it, that you get another visa? You need your country, Timor-Leste, to approve that visa. You need Australia to approve that visa. And you need a sponsor, an employer. Yeah. So what's that like, always knowing that you will have to leave, that you can't stay? How do you plan for the future?
I'm not planning to my future. I just, you know, keep work and let the time flow where I'm going. That's all. You don't have to think a lot.
Live in the moment.
Live in the moment. Just as long as you keep working, enjoy your life.
Nunes and his wife, who recently got through the lottery process for a new category of visa, it's called the Pacific Engagement Visa. 3,000 of these permanent visas are available to people on Palm visas and would allow access to a whole lot of things, education, Medicare and support payments. In Australia, it's a chance to plan for the future, perhaps. Let's come now to questions from the audience at the Australian National University.
First of all, thank you very much for this interesting discussion, very insightful. I'm really interested in this policy aspect. To me, the POM system is a system of control. That it basically, the fear is if you give the workers access to permanent residence, to citizenship, to TAFE, whatever it is, that they'll leave. They won't do the work. So I guess my question to you is, do you think that would happen? Do you think if workers were given more freedoms, if they had free movement like they do with New Zealand, would the agricultural sector get the workers they need, or would you have to, what's the solution there?
Yeah, thank you. That's a really powerful question, and we have a question here. I'll just take them in the row because then there might be overlapping themes.
Thank you. I'm Dr. Julie Cunningham, and I'm a postdoctoral research fellow with Dr. Matt Withers, and we're researching the social impacts of the POM scheme. In my previous research project in Tonga, I interviewed and had surveys with 180 school children, and 25% of them indicated that they'd had a parent living overseas working in Australia, New Zealand or the United States. And they described the parent becoming a stranger to them in that period, and many of them spoke of family breakdown. In our work in Fiji, we've heard from social workers there about family breakdown being a significant issue and women being left particularly destitute as they're no longer receiving remittances from the palm worker, and that children are becoming more and more at risk. One social worker said, it's almost like when we created these schemes and agreed to these schemes, we only thought about the economic gain and we didn't think about the social impacts for our people in our country. I just would wonder what the panel thinks about the cost of this in terms of social impacts, and who steps in to provide the care when 25% of parents are overseas.
Mm. Thank you very much.
This is where we're needing to be working together. They're needing to bring in, the churches, the support networks in their own countries together to be part of the solution.
Final comment to you two, and then we have to wrap.
All right. I just want to answer the policy question. The position paper that's been produced by local government areas under the Mayor Alliance does cite the activation of the mobility component within the PALM scheme. So the answer to your question is that it's untried. We can't tell because we haven't tried it. But if we activate that mobility component and trace it over time, we'll be able to establish whether it's actually a trigger for good, a better outcome in terms of longevity of employment, or it is causing headaches and presenting a problem within the program.
Kaya, final comment to you.
If you're asking if you give somebody residency, permanent residency or citizenship after working and living for a long time, like a decade in Australia, who cares if they move to the city afterwards? I mean, they've done more than enough service. But I think if you offer this in a way that's careful and meaningful, and you can show people what life could be like long term, if they can bring their family, if they can bring their mum and dad out to visit, buy a house, rent a place long term, then they'll set up and they'll make a life there in the regions and in rural places. And that's the sort of people we want to attract and keep. They're already there. We just have to keep them. Thanks.
Thank you all. Thank you so much. And there's more from the audience, including questions from the High Commissioner of Vanuatu, Samson Vilvilfare, who was at the event, as was the High Commissioner of Tonga, Curtis Leonard Tui-Helangi-Ngi. And with me on this panel, recorded live at the Australian National University, were Emma Vuetti, who's president of the Pacific Islands Council of Queensland, Ken Darchi, coordinator of Welcoming Workplaces with Welcoming Australia, and Dr. Kaya Barry, a cultural geographer and senior lecturer with Griffith University's Centre for Social and Cultural Research. Thanks also to Kaya's collaborators, Dr. Matt Withers at the ANU and Dr. Kirsty Petru at the University of New South Wales. And you can share this episode or hear it again. Just download the ABC Listen app in Australia onto your phone, search for Big Ideas, hit follow, and that way you can get all our podcasts, or find Big Ideas wherever you get your podcasts if you're outside of Australia, or on the Big Ideas website. Just search ABC Radio National and Big Ideas and you'll find us. And if you've had an experience of the PALM Visa scheme in a community across Australia, perhaps as a local resident or as a PALM worker yourself, we'd love to hear your thoughts on what you've heard today Our email address is bigideas@abc.net.au. That's bigideas@abc.net.au. Get in touch. I'm Natasha Mitchell. Back with you next time with more Big Ideas.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.